Let me just make explicit something that I'm doing in this meeting, in the next meeting, in the class. I'm doing something rather unusual pedagogically. We'll see if it works. Which is, I'm talking about Putnam's reading of McDowell before we talk about McDowell. It's not bad organization. Doing it on purpose might be a bad idea, but it's not just bad organization. The reason for that is because I think it's hard to read McDowell, and I think there's an extremely natural misreading of it, which becomes extremely vivid and explicit in Putnam. So I don't think Putnam is making a stupid mistake. He's falling into a way of understanding what McDowell's doing that is out there more or less in a lot of the literature, more or less inchoately. And the nice thing about the Putnam is it's happening in a vivid enough way that one can see the problems with it. And so part of the point of doing that is that when we turn to the McDowell, and hopefully you're still reading the McDowell for Wednesday, you're worried about how you're understanding what you're reading as you're reading it. I'm trying to warn you off a very natural way of picking up. So it seems that it's clear what he's doing. It's very familiar. But that's because you're actually refracting the whole thing through a Cartesian lens, which you yourself have acquired, and even just a few philosophy courses have taken. Because that's what tends to happen, especially in early philosophy courses, is we're exposed to philosophical problems often that have some Cartesian shape. Not necessarily. It depends who your teacher is, what you've learned, what kind of course you come in on. But often, that's what happens. So that's part of the strategy here. So I'm going to be saying things about McDowell before you've read him, or before we're talking about him explicitly in a textual way, which I want you to go out and test in your own reading of him. So that's one thing we're doing at a more textual level. At a more systematic level, independently of the particular philosophers we're looking at, Putnam and McDowell, I'm interested in bringing out for you how words that express certain kinds of philosophical worries or philosophical positions by answering certain philosophical questions themselves can have a kind of instability built into them, or at least an instability in different people's understandings of what the issues are, depending upon how they waffle with respect to the issues we're discussing here. This is only an example of this, but it's a particularly good example. And we had these two questions: how does language hook onto the world? Do our cognitive powers reach all the way to the objects themselves? And I'm now putting the board two more examples of such questions / assertions / quotations, which I think are all sort of in the same basket. That is, your understanding of any of these is such that your understanding of the others will probably take in the washing of the others. So that, but just to show you how these things spread. Number three I've written really small, so you might think you can't read it, but it's on your handout. So you can read it off your hand, and I just wanted it on the board so I could point to it. It's a quotation from Wittgenstein. When we say and mean that such and such is the case, we in our meaning do not stop anywhere short of the fact. And for the moment in today's lecture, or today's presentation, I want to bracket even any discussion, you know, the context this comes up in Wittgenstein. Maybe what Wittgenstein meant by this is something completely different. Let's not even worry about that. It suffices for my purposes today. It's enough trouble if we can see that Putnam and McDowell are putting this quotation to completely different uses. That will be enough to make my point for today. What might someone mean by these words is enough of an issue for us to get started today. We have, again, do not stop anywhere short of the fact. That could be taken to be some version of this question. The cognitive power here is our ability to say things or our ability to mean things. Does that stop short of the things we say and mean? Or does it not stop anywhere short? Does it go all the way too? Whatever that picture means here, that could be taken to be a version of this. You've got some specification now. We're talking about saying and meaning. We're not just talking vaguely about cognitive powers. Does that make a difference or not? Here's another kind of issue. Is blah, blah, blah responsible to reality? very common kind of issue in philosophy. A lot of philosophy and mathematics, starting with a famous essay by the philosopher and mathematician J.H. Harding, is about, are mathematical claims responsible to any reality? You say 2 plus 2 equals 4. Are you just playing some self-contained mathematical game? The truth of those things just followed from the axioms and the rules of inference? Or is there some further notion of mathematical truth that goes beyond bare consistency? Or the mathematical claims themselves, if you're doing the real stuff, are true. And then that looks like it means true of something. True of what? True of the empirical world? Well, that looks like it's going to get into a bit of trouble. So, true to a non-empirical world? Some people have said yes, but it's hard to find that non-empirical world. If you bounce sine waves off it, it looks like it was empirical after all. If you can't bounce anything off it, what is it? So, there's a question we want to ask here. Hardy tries to put it carefully, without any commitments, by saying, are they responsible to reality? To some different reality, to say, do they have some bearings or so? Is there some way in which, when you're getting things right in mathematics, there's a sense of getting right that goes beyond playing a mathematical game? So this is a kind of phrase that comes up a lot in philosophy. That's one context. Putnam's Dewey Lecture start, quotation 4. Sorry, my pagination is from the reprinted version of them in the Threefold Court. And since I learned that I can't put more than one chapter of a book in without violating Norwegian copyright law, but if it's in the Journal of Philosophy, I can put three lectures in it. It doesn't matter because it's not a book. I took it from the Journal of Philosophy so I could give you the whole thing. But so then I realized I was giving you the wrong pagination. But, you know, it's going to be roughly page 4 in the Journal of Philosophy, which is quite early. Putnam starts out by asking, he's warming up to this claim that it's all about the interface conception. By page 10, we've reached this climax. But on page 4, he sets up his issue by saying, are our knowledge claims responsible to reality? That looks like the question. And I picked that phrase because this kind of language also occurs in McDonald, The Mind and the World. It's an issue about the responsibility, or as he sometimes puts it, vulnerability of claims to reality. McDonald doesn't say knowledge claims. Is that just a little bit of detail or not? Come to that in a second. But so these are, you know, I want to say, further examples of places where philosophers can go, oh yes, I think that's the issue. Oh yes, I think that's the right answer. And what you have is apparent agreement. What you have between McDowell and Putnam here is, I think, a spectacular case of nearly apparent agreement in philosophy. A few classes will look at an equally spectacular case of merely apparent disagreement. Two philosophers, I think, aren't disagreeing about anything, but boy, are they ready to kill each other over the fact that one of them is willing to affirm a sentence that has the form of one the other is willing to deny. Okay, so let's get a little further into this. So, this is a quotation from Wittgenstein. It figures prominently, as you'll see, in Mind and World. I think it's quoted on page 27. But it's a sort of touchstone for something McDowell wants to say, which he thinks, faced with a certain kind of philosophical bind, we're forced to deny. McDowell would take what Wittgenstein's saying here, if this helps any, this may be going a bit fast, but McDowell would take on his understanding of what Wittgenstein's saying here to be a way of disagreeing with the first quotation on your handout last time from C.I. Lewis, where C.I. Lewis said, neither the given and the pure concept limit one another. I'm sorry, the pure concept and the given do limit one another. No, neither one determines one another. So neither one limits one another. So There's that space we had on the board. There must be a kind of independence, Lewis thought, in order for knowledge to have content. And McDowell is going to take himself to be disagreeing with that, so to be disagreeing with a very fundamental assumption, which he thinks Wittgenstein would want to disagree with. That wasn't helpful, don't worry about it. We'll come back to it. But the main thing we want for right now is just, here's something Wittgenstein says McDowell agrees with. It's the kind of sentence in McDowell, while Putnam's saying this about the interface conception and starting his book with item 4 in your handout saying, are our knowledge claims responsible to reality? Yes, they are. This is what the interface conception does not allow us to see. He'll read a sentence like this in Putnam's agreeing with it, in McDowell, and McDowell's agreeing with it and think, yes, we're on the same page. And indeed, it's even more extreme here. Putnam takes himself to be explaining McDowell to us, not just finding agreement, but to be actually spelling out McDowell's views. So Putnam wants, I mean, here's a way of bringing out the problem very vividly, the kind of waffle. The interface conception says our cognitive powers cannot reach all the way themselves, the objects themselves. That's what the interface conception says. Putnam wants to deny that. He wants to assert the negation of what a holder of the interface conception says. Inserting the negation of that, he wants to be doing two things at once. He wants to be saying, this Cartesian assumption is a bad thing, the cause of our philosophical problems, and we're saying no to it. That's one thing he wants to be doing. Second thing he wants to be doing is agreeing with what McDowell was saying when he quotes Wittgenstein here in his understanding. He wants to be saying, yes, they can reach all the way to themselves. Our cognitive powers can. When we say and mean something's the case, it doesn't stop anywhere short of the fact. He wants the negation. He wants the positive answer to this question, the negation to what the interface conception asserts, to both be doing both those things at once. That's a way of trying to bring out something he wants and saying he can't have. That there's a waffle there. He can overthrow the interface conception and his understanding of it, and he can agree with McDowell. But those aren't the same philosophical issue. There isn't anything which is saying one thing in one set of sentence, which is doing both those things at once. It's not that those things are incompatible. It's just that those are two different kinds of philosophical work, which he's running together at the same time. So there's kind of unclarity about what the issue is. And it's quite clear that he wants us to take it both ways, as I'll try to show you. The point of quotation 4, where the word Cartesian even figures, is that he wants the negation of this, the negation of the skeptic's answer to this question, to be refusal of Cartesian assumption. And it's also quite clear he wants to be agreeing with McDowell when McDowell says that kind of thing. If you read the Dewey lectures, it's quite clear that he wants to be doing both those things at once. He doesn't take that to be doing two different things. Okay. Now, to actually prove that this is a big confusion in 30 minutes, 35 minutes, maybe more than I can do, mostly what I'm giving you is a template for reading this with a certain critical eye yourself. But let me make some remarks that can help you start to smell the trouble here if you're looking for it. Notice first one kind of slippage, which I've already briefly drawn attention to. Might put an extra parenthesis here. Putnam says, are our knowledge claims responsible to reality? That's the question he is taking up explicitly in the Dewey lectures, he says. McDowell in Mind and World is interested in what it would be for claims to be responsible to reality. Now you might think the difference there is one just of generality. McDowell's interested in more kinds of claims than Putnam. Putnam's only focusing on knowledge claims.
McDowell's asking the same question. He's asking about maybe other kinds of claims besides knowledge claims or something. But no, I don't think that's the difference. The difference is in what this bit here winds up meaning. With the difference in question comes a difference with issue. McDowell's problem, I'm sorry, let's start at Putnam. Putnam's problem, are knowledge claims responsible to reality? Is one where he means to be explicitly taking up a certain kind of problem in Cartesian philosophy of perception that we've already talked a lot about. Here I am, standing in front of the classroom. I have a perceptual basis for claiming I'm in front of a classroom. But if there's no way to distinguish between I'm dreaming I'm in front of the classroom, I'm in front, and my being in front of the classroom, then my knowledge claim, based on my perceptual experience, is only answerable to how things seem. The basis for the claim is locked within a self-contained perceptual space. How reality is blankly obtains, to borrow a phrase from the other McDowell essay that Putnam read earlier and made such an impression on him. How reality is blankly obtains over and beyond anything that my claim is based on. My claim looks like it's only responsible to my perception. It looks like it can't be responsible to reality. Even on Descartes' refutation of skepticism, it's only because God is not a deceiver. And he designed us, and he designed reality, and he made the whole thing fit. That it turns out that my claim, which is based on my perception, turns out to also be responsible to reality. That's, as it were, a function of the fortuitous wiring of the whole setup because of our benevolent designer. But the claim itself is only based on how things seem, on my clear and distinct ideas. I can't get beyond those. Putnam says, what's the mistake? The mistake is this gap where we think that perception itself is the self-contained realm. We need to get rid of that assumption. We need our claim to be based on, now let's use a word that will come up in McDowell's Mind and World too, another world that can shift around. Open to. Our perception is open to reality itself. Putnam wants to say, in the perceptually veridical case, when I hear believe, that I'm standing in front of a room full of people because I perceive it. The basis of my claim is the room full of people. It's not a mere perception, that, such and such. So he wants to say the claim is based on reality. There is no perceptual interface that is the same in the case of the veridical perception and the non-veridical perception. There's always a perceptual interface, something coming between me and reality. When I make a knowledge claim, it's the crucial assumption. Now, if you read McDowell's Criteria to Feasibility of Knowledge, which you will do if you've never done it before this class is over, you'll see that McDowell can agree with all of that. But he'll also say this is not an interpretation of mind and world. It's not the point of what I'm doing in this book. You misunderstood it. So that's what Putnam means. That's a very quick way to try to bring out that Putnam, something Putnam's trying to say when he says, are our knowledge claims responsible to reality? But notice it depends on knowledge claims, on the veridical perceptions being responsible to reality. Responsible to reality here means directly in touch with, without a perceptual interface, and therefore true. So, on this understanding of responsible to reality, if I'm dreaming, then my perceptual experience is not responsible to reality. And it's not a knowledge claim. He's only saying about the knowledge claims can be responsible to reality. He's not saying the dreams are responsible here. Is a term that's sorting the true from the false. The ones where we are open to reality in this sense, there is no perceptual distraction in the form of dream or hallucination, and ones where we're not. When McDowell asked the question, are our claims responsible to reality?
What he wants to know is, to borrow another way, McDowell puts it, how is it that claims can so much as have empirical content? If I make a claim, I'm standing in front of a class, how is that the kind of thing that could be true or false? That comes up about the true ones and the false ones. That comes up about the claim that's contained in my dream, just as much as the claim that's contained in my waking state.
If we didn't have that kind of responsibility to reality, to go back to that quotation from the A deduction of Kant's, then experience would be less than a dream. Here, responsibility to reality, that's why you can substitute claims for thoughts in McDowell. How is it that our thoughts can so much as be responsible for reality, have a bearing on reality, be vulnerable such they turn out to be true or false in the light of how things are? Whereas Putnam's question isn't how our thoughts can be responsible for reality, and his use of the term responsible reality, it's how can our true thoughts be responsible in the sense in which he's using it. This phrase, responsible to reality, does not mean the same thing in Putnam and McDowell, because the issue is not the same. It sounds very, you know, it's the same, similar as an understatement. You can use the same words to ask both their questions, so it can sound identical in the sense of mere sound, but doesn't make it the same issue. It has the same structure. So the very fact that there's this emphasis on knowledge would be, to McDowell, a sign that something's probably already gone wrong in Putnam's explication of McDowell's mind and world. McDowell's constantly talking about claims. Any claims. How can they have the content they do? McDowell's emphasizing, so that's one way you can see it. Another way you can see the difference in spin is by looking at the Wittgenstein quotation that McDowell wants to emphasize. This is the kind of quotation McDowell used to set up his problem. The issue is, how can what we say and mean fall anywhere short of the fact? That fits better with the McDowell construal. Wittgenstein's question isn't obviously, at least it isn't on McDowell's understanding of it. How can it be when we say and mean that such and such is the case, if what we say is true, that it stop, that it not stop anywhere short of the fact? There's no suppressed clause here, if what we say is true. The question is, how can what we say and mean be such that it has that kind of bearing on reality, true or false? If I say there are weapons of mass destruction, how can I say the kind of thing that can be overturned or not? That's how McDowell understands the issue here. And so the emphasis being on meaning rather than knowledge brings out the issue of what kind of power this is issue here is quite different. On the initial Putnam construal, the kind of power that's at issue here is knowledge. The kind of power, for instance, of doubting, isn't in question. It's a certain kind of Cartesian doubt we're trying to overthrow by saying we are in touch. No need to doubt. That's what the refusal of the interface conception is doing for Putnam, at least the beginning of the lectures. Whereas in McDowell, the kind of cognitive powers that are issue in our meaning, first and foremost, claiming. Be able to say something is bearing. But with it, therefore, claims that express doubts. Doubting, too. How can those things have the kind of determinate content that they do? That's the issue in McDowell. It's a different issue. I want to be clear. It doesn't follow just the fact that he's used this word and he's used this word. That's a different issue. But I do think you can see a difference in emphasis here. And if you read around, you'll see that this difference of emphasis is not an accident, but it fits with the overall problematics they have. Yes?
I want to ask him to give an answer to this problem.
Which problem?
That he's confusing the confusion and the content in the doubt.
You mean, if I get Putnam clear, but...
Give a response to your reading of him.
Yeah. Not one that I found very satisfying.
Okay.
But he hasn't given anything in print that I've seen. Here's a non-encouraging sign. He's published a reply to McDowell, since he and I have talked about all of this, in a book called, I can't remember what it's called. What's that book called? Edited by Nicholas...
Reading McDowell's Mind and
World. Reading McDowell's Mind and World. So it's an anthology called Reading Mind and World, which contains an essay from McDowell, an essay from Putnam, which has criticisms of McDowell that I think turn on the same misreading, in part. I mean, there's other criticisms that are just wrong for other reasons. But we also talked about those. So that might suggest that I haven't convinced him of much. On the other hand, you know, he has said things like, yes, 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 I know you're right. I have to be careful not to confuse Cartesian and Kantian skeptic and so forth. And he and I have been at conferences and things. And he'll say, yes, yes, well, Conan has pointed out that we must not confuse these things, blah, 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 blah. But then sometimes he'll go on and say things that I think still involve that confusion. And then if I raise my hand and say, well, I've already agreed with you, then of course it's important not to confuse these things. The problem in philosophy is it's much harder to actually avoid making certain mistakes than it is to just agree that they are mistakes. Yeah. McDowell's criticism of Sellars is that he commits the myth of the given. There's nothing Sellars is more worried about than the myth of the given. One of Wittgenstein's central criticisms of Frege is that he falls into psychologism. There's nothing that Frege is more interested in doing than avoiding psychologism. So this is what happens in philosophy. It's not enough for some philosopher to say, well, yes, I agree that we want to avoid this mistake. If it's a really deep and interesting philosophical mistake, your desire not to commit it, it's sort of like every time you get in your car saying, I promise I will never get into a traffic accident. Well, it might not get you there. You know, the sincerity of your intention notwithstanding. Philosophical traffic accidents occur even in the face of that. So I think my sense of Putnam is, yeah, he thinks there's a point here. Maybe he made a problem. He committed a mistake with respect to it. He needs to sort these things out. But he's not sure how deep it goes. And from my point of view, it hasn't really gotten a hold of it because he keeps falling back into it. But as you'll see, we're just starting by really focusing on Putnam. But I'm going to raise issues about McDowell, too, and whether he's got this under control as well. So I think, you know, if I'm right about the way in which one can lapse into a certain kind of confusion because the philosophical vocabulary we use is so easily slides from one issue to another that we get into trouble, then it's going to come up a lot. It's not that Putnam is particularly unique here. I'm just choosing an essay. There's lots of things of Putnam's I could have chosen where I don't think he is sliding around. He's got a firm grip on a particular philosophical issue he's talking about, and he's just talking about that one. It's because he's trying in these lectures to do something very synthetic and to connect lots of things and say, this is the fundamental problem in perception and language, then and now, that he gets into trouble, I think. But I guess the real answer is you'd have to let, you know, Hillary speak for himself. If he were here right now, I really don't know what he would say. I think he'd be something like, yeah, Jim's got an important point here, but I think he exaggerates it. He'd probably say something like that. We did have a big argument about, we did have an argument with Hillary about quotation 5 in your handout, which we're about to go through. We won't get to it for another minute, but this, I'll just say this in connection to your question. And what do you want to say about quotation 5? As you'll see in quotation 5, just so it doesn't take too long, I was giving a lecture sort of like what I'm doing in this class. I had the quotation just the way it is now, with a lot of dot, dot, dots. That is, what I've given you here is about a paragraph worth. It takes place over 3.5 pages of Putnam's lectures. And Putnam said, the reason it looks like there's a problem here is because you've left out all of this text in between. And if we added all of that text, then you'd see that I haven't you know, gotten myself into the trouble you said. And I did sit down with Hillary once, and we went through those 3.5 pages with all of the texting, and he agreed it didn't help at all. You know, if there wasn't a problem, he wasn't going to fix it by adding that text. So we've had some discussions like that, you know. But, you know, in philosophy, it's hard work, you know. If you say someone's got a mistake and they think they haven't got a mistake, it's not always easy to figure out who's right. What we decided is that adding all of that text didn't help him. He agreed to that. But then he said, well, if you read the rest of the lectures, you'll see, actually, if you read the Dewey lectures, I think there's a footnote early on where I'm thanked very much for my comments. It's on the first page. I was raising these questions, you know, before he published them. And then he said, well, I fixed all of the problems. And then he published them and thanked me for, you know, sort of like, you know, McDowell's on my side. Jim Comet's on my side, too. No, Hillary, I want to be on your side. I love you. But you didn't fix the problem. So, you know, so the conversation goes on. I'm trying to recover my sense of where we are. So meaning, knowledge. We talked about that. So, I was talking about how the phrase responsibility to reality is another one of these phrases we could have put on the board when we had all those quotations on the board when we were looking at Price and Lewis, of phrases that can move back and forth between the different registers and function quite differently depending upon which one they're in. If you're in the Kantian problematic of the sort that McDowell's worrying about, the kind of responsibility or vulnerability to reality, you know, to borrow Kant's word, you know, the kind of objektive Gültigkeit, the kind of objective validity or purport, that kind of bearing to reality, that's an issue there. We must capitalize our nouns in German. Is one where the issue concerns true, false, and true claims and false claims, valid perceptual experiences and dreams, knowledge and doubt. Statements that are true and false, they are equally meaningful. It's the conditions of meaning something at all. That's an issue. I think, indeed, this is often a way in which both Kant and Wittgenstein are misunderstood. It's not just happening in Putnam. Very often when people talk about, say, rule following, they'll talk about the conditions under which the application of this concept is true. It's a very common way of phrasing what the rule following problematic is about. How can we know our use of the concept is true? What's the rule following problem? How do I know when I call something right, it's right? What are the cases in which using this word, you know, is being predicated the right sort of thing? So the whole thing is starting to take a shape of how do I pick out the true cases from the other cases? I think in Wittgenstein, not always, he's concerned with issues about knowledge in certain places, but always against the background of his more fundamental concerns. Same in Kant. He's concerned with Cartesian problematics in certain places, but always against the background of his more fundamental concern with what I'm calling Kantian skepticism. The fundamental issue in Wittgenstein, usually in the first instance, is with meaning. How can our words mean something? Is thinking that you mean something enough to know that you mean something? What do you have to do with words such that there could be correctness or incorrectness? What does it take for there to be a language game to play? Play it badly, but it's there to be played. That's usually the first level of issue. The issue isn't how do we know we're using it truthfully. Yes?
Just a small question about the German word Gültigkeit.
Yeah.
You know, we have the word in Norwegian as well, Gültigkeit.
Uh-huh.
It's the same thing. And it normally means truth, not false.
Right.
So you say validity or purport. Where do you get the purport
from? From this. That is, the issue in Kant is how can it have a kind of, How can it be putting forward something that has an objective bearing? Mm-hmm. So how can there be a difference between, you know, the kind of issue Kant's worried about, say, in section 19 is, if I say, this stone is heavy, just connecting one sensation with another sensation, and saying something that has the form of a judgment, so that I'm not just connecting two things in me, but as he puts it, I'm connecting two representations in the object. So subjective validity has to do with things seeming this way to me.
But you said that the Cartesian problematic had to do with how true propositions, or what kind of bearing true proposition have on reality. And
why would be
true?
Well, that's a very vague way of putting it, because then the bearing and reality, what you're doing is you're taking a phrase, bearing and reality, the kind of Kantian phrase, and you're shoving it back into a Cartesian format where you're giving a different kind of content. what the Cartesian is interested in is, how do I know among my claims which of them is true? What you're interested in, if you're interested in the fundamental Kantian question, is how can I claim something that has the form of a judgment? That when I say the two concepts are related, I say S is phi, I'm saying something that has the form of a judgment that could be right or wrong, that could involve, you know, bringing intuitions to the synthetic unity of consciousness, as God says, section 19 of the Deduction. Now, you can take the word bearing and drop it in the middle of either of those problematics, but I'm saying it's functioning differently.
Yeah, but I want to raise a question about the translation of Gültigkeit.
Right.
It seems to me that the translation.
Well, my claim is not.
The purport seems to fit your.
Well, I'm saying when Kant's concerned with this issue, he's concerned with an issue about how we are able to have judgments that have this kind of bearing. But I'm not making a translational issue about any word in Kant. I mean, I don't think a good way to read Kant is to try to figure out, you know, what he means by Vorstellung, by first looking at, you know, a general German dictionary, you know. Ich möchte ihm vorstellen. I would like to introduce you to Richard. That's not a good way to start asking the question, you know, what the scope of that concept is. So I'm not making a translational claim about German then. You know, sure, the word Gültigkeit, you know, has all of the scope of a word like, you know, Gültig means valid, or, you know, or something counts, you know. This currency, you know, is valid in this country, and so forth. I mean, it has a huge scope of meaning. I don't think we can figure out what Kant's issue is by working off of that word, just the verb gelten, to count or be valid. But I am saying that the issue that Kant's worried about here is one that is more closely related to the kind of topic that McDowell is finding in Wittgenstein than the topic that Putnam is finding in Descartes. That's what I want to say. But I also was trying to say that it's not forced by any of these words, you know. You know, the word mean, you know, itself has different things. You know, one of the things you can mean by the word mean is not how can I come up with a statement that has the kind of form that's true or false. X is phi. One of the things you can mean by mean is I mean my mother. You can have what's called objectual meaning. So we're not concerned with, as Frege would put it, the Sinn of a proposition, but we're concerned with the Bedeutung of a term. And then that is picking out a particular. You know, and that gets into, you know, a different. So I'm not saying this work forces that issue either. We will never be able to. I want one of my morals to be, you can't tell what the issue is from the words alone. But if you look at how the words spread and how the issue unfolds, and you have a whole set of features and it has a certain kind of logic, then you can start to see what the philosophical issues are. But I mean, part of my point is that whole sentences, any of these sentences, can slide between the problematic. I'm not saying there's some words that sort of have Kantian or Cartesian you know, sort of stamped on their trademark. So if they slide over there, you know there's a problem. It's not, it really, unfortunately, is much harder than that. I really don't want to be claiming that. And so not for this word either. Not for any word will I claim that. Alas. Ooh, 10 minutes left. I have to make some decisions. Let's look at the quotation. Quotation 5. Let's now ask why realism about the external world came to seem problematic. Early modern philosophers, it's quotation 5, early modern philosophers assumed that the immediate objects of perception were mental, and that mental objects were non-physical. What is more, even their materialist opponents put forward accounts of perception that closely paralleled these Cartesian accounts. So, we've clearly got a setup here where the initial problem, it's, again, it happens really fast, as we saw it did in the press. It's assuming familiarity with a kind of background in philosophy. But I think it's fairly clear the background in philosophy we're supposed to be familiar with here is one of a Cartesian construal of the problem. And one of the things you can see here is how dangerous it is in philosophy. You know, in physics, you know, if people have taken introductory Newtonian mechanics and solid state physics and electromagnetism, then you can start teaching relativity theory. And you can start saying, well, the problem in relativity theory is how do we unify our account of mechanical phenomena, electromagnetic phenomena. And the student's supposed to know what that is and that is, because they took previous courses. And the fantasy in philosophy is we can do the same thing. We can start saying, I want to start talking about materialism, and I refer back to a certain problem. You've all already studied. But the problem in philosophy is, what was that problem we already studied? If you do it quickly, there's a lot of philosophical unclarity that can immediately creep in. You actually have to know. I think in philosophy, who his teacher was, they used the textbook was, what actually were they, what did they think that problem was? There isn't anything which stands to introductory philosophy as Newtonian mechanics stands to introductory physics. So we can just go to, you know, advance. If you have a very sort of ideologically regimented philosophy department where everybody shares a common conception of the subject, then you can take the introductory course at Princeton and the intermediate course, but then go to some other department and start talking. And then you conclude, well, those guys are stupid. They don't know what serious philosophy are, which is what philosophers often conclude about each other when they change departments. So, very quickly, we're pointing at some issue, which is supposed to be a fundamental issue. It's pretty clear, I think, that it's meant to here have a Cartesian shape for Putnam, even apart from his using the word Cartesian, which I don't want to itself, you know, be playing a role of knockout evidence here. And then he's saying, well, the problem in contemporary science is the fashion to hypothesize the existence of representations in the cerebral computer. If one assumes that the mind is an organ, one goes to identify the mind with the brain, it will then become irresistible to think of some of the representations as analogous to the classical theorist's impressions, and to think that those impressions are linked to objects in the organism's environment, not only causally, but cognitively. Now, one of the things I should tell you here is, the life is so complicated that the following is true. Putnam is here reciting things that McDowell says. Early McDowell. There's not only Criteria to Feasibility Knowledge, but there are other essays. One essay that's somewhat later, but it's quite relevant, is an essay McDowell's called The Content of Perceptual Experience. So, which I can't remember which of his two volumes that's in right now. I think it's at the end of the Mind, Value, Reality ones, right?
It is, but it doesn't make it. That's quite late,
no, it's quite less essay, but they're not late.
Written about the same time as when the book.
Right, no, but it's, well, it depends what late here means. If late means date of publication, yes.
Yeah, okay.
But it's a kind of, it's material he's thinking about for a long time. One of the things that McDowell does, which makes it hard to date his stuff, is he has certain lectures he gives for years because he needs to have a lecture to give. And then finally he agrees to publish it. So there's certain essays that were published after Mind and World, like his essay in the Davidson Festschrift. But it's about 12 years earlier, and that's actually the seed out of which Mind and World grew. So I think the dating can't be just a function of publication date. But also, as we'll see, when we look at McDowell, he thinks there is a connection between these two problematics. So it's not that he's lost interest in one and switched to the other. He's got an overall view of how these things hang together. All I'm saying is you can't use some of the things he says about the Cartesian problematic as a lens for just reading Mind and World, or you go wrong. And I think McDowell would agree with that. But what you do have, but what McDowell would be perfectly happy with, as we'll see, whether he's right or wrong about this, is that in the Cartesian format, you have an assumption of what, you know, McDowell calls inner space. You have an assumption of a certain kind of self-standing realm. In philosophy of perception, the self-standing realm is sort of like the perceptual, how things seem to me. And it's that hypostasization of the perceptual disconnected from what the content of perception is, the objects, that's the crucial mistake. That's what he thinks is the crucial mistake. And so, from McDowell's point of view, then assuming the representations, so understood, are something material rather than something mental, just keeps that assumption in place. The self-standingness of the realm, that the representations could all have of this content, simply by taking place, simply by following each other in the physical space instead of the mental space, hasn't been attacked. What we tried to get out of the problem by treating a symptom of the problem, which seems ontologically fishy about the space of representation, that it's mental, while holding the crucial assumption, which we might call, Putnam calls it the interface conception. I think McDowell would be happier with calling the crucial assumption here something like the self-standingness of inner space, or the Cartesian conception of mental, that is, having a gap. I mean, Putnam makes it sort of sound like the description of the two sides is fine. The problem is the idea of an interface. Let's just move them closer together so they touch. Let's just change the geometry of the picture, and everything will be all right. Whereas I think McDowell might be happier to put the objection a slightly different way. But what's certainly right is that Putnam could cite McDowell, the idea that the assumption that mind is an organ, that is, to say it's an organ is a way of taking its capacities to be self-standingly actualizable, regardless of its environment, regardless of any further story of what it takes to enjoy such contents. And then materializing it while keeping that assumption in place. Putnam could certainly cite McDowell and say, see, McDowell agrees with me about this. But the problem is that this is all an explanation of what McDowell's doing in Mind and World. And there, McDowell doesn't mean to be repeating those other thoughts of his. In fact, he means to be going to what he thinks is a much more fundamental issue. It's actually... I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of Mind and World on me, but since you'll be reading it next time, a sentence you might look out for. We assign lectures 1 and 2, didn't we? But you might, since you've gotten the book, you might want to read the sort of... this. Here it matters that you have the second edition, not the first edition. In the second edition, he added a kind of introduction or précis to the beginning of the book. That's partly a response to certain misunderstandings. I think Putnam's one of the people he has in mind. And there's a sentence there where he talks about a certain kind of philosophical worry being an inchoate and inept expression of a more fundamental philosophical anxiety. I think that's pretty much a straight quote what I just said. A way of putting what he's saying there is that this kind of Cartesian issue, he thinks, is an inchoate and inept expression of something which later in the history of philosophy clarifies itself as a much more fundamental philosophical anxiety of the sort that he's taking himself to address in Mind and World. So he thinks there's a connection between these two things, but he would feel that Mind and World was completely being misunderstood if what it was doing was taking itself to just be reformulating the questions in Cartesian terms. That would be, by his lights, to be continuing to keep the issues in inchoate and inept formulation of what the fundamental issue is. I was going to go through this quotation, but I'm running out of time. So let me just tell you what I would try to show you if we went through it slowly.
Putnam wants the contemporary, does language hook onto the world issue? That McDowell, sometimes him and other people have been worrying about, itself to simultaneously be addressed by his challenge of a Cartesian assumption in philosophy of perception.
And I don't think that's going to work. I think if you look at people like McDowell himself, or Bob Brandon, or Michael Dummett, or lots of other people who are interested in this kind of question, they're not going to be worried by Putnam's challenge of the interface session conception in Cartesian philosophy of language, philosophy of perception. Indeed, a number of them are going to say, well, yes, I think you're exactly right about that. But this is a different problem. They'll claim it's a completely different problem. They might not be right about that. But it's not going to have any force to say, here's the crucial mistake, the interface conception, understood in Cartesian terms. If they think they can agree with that, and that doesn't touch the problem they have in the philosophy of language, because the problem they're having in the philosophy of language is not how do we sort our true claims from our false claims, given that there's this interface. But they think their question is, how can there so much as be a fact of the matter about it, to quote Kripke, whether we're adding or clouding? If they think that's their problem, you're not going to see the bearing of this. Now, Putnam takes these two things to be connected because he realizes there's a kind of phraseology that moves across the two cases. But the question is, why are we addressing the same problem and clearly addressing the assumption on a Cartesian construal of the phraseology? Is that going to therefore immediately hit the people who are worried about this kind of issue in philosophy of language? I don't think they're going to feel moved. I think they're going to read the Dewey Lectures and think, well, all very well, but this is old hat. Doesn't criticize me. And I think McDowell's going to think, no, this is a misunderstanding of what I'm doing. Thank you very much. But I do mean to be criticizing those people who are addressing this issue. And you're teaching them to read it this way is causing them to misunderstand the force of my book. Whether they agree with it or not, once they understand it, this is keeping them from even understanding what I'm trying to do in the book. So that's the setup, a class on Wednesday. It's one big prolegomena. I'm sorry if it seems like too big a warm-up for the final pitch, but it's a prolegomena for now turning to McDowell's Mind and World and trying to see how what he's doing in that book is related with respect to the issues that we've looked in the class.